Welcome to Where We Belong, a podcast exploring all that Cavan heritage has to offer. We made the journey to Cavan Town today to spend some time with conservation architect David Cullivan, who shared with us his love for the architectural heritage of Cavan and gave us an insight into his important work. So, sit back, relax, and spend some quality time with Cavan and its people.
Hello, how are you? You're very welcome to 1 Farnham Street. Please go up the stairs to the boardroom and we'll have a chat. It's in there to your right-hand side. My dad was an architect and worked an awful lot in old buildings in the 70s and 80s. He was involved in a lot of church refurbishments, amongst other things. And as a small child, he used to take me away from my homework to go out and measure the buildings. And I got to draw some of them for him. So I suppose without realizing it, I found myself learning a certain amount about old buildings at that time. And then I went off and I studied architecture. I don't think there's any child who hasn't walked up a step in an old building that's worn and dished and cupped. You all know what I mean by that. Who hasn't had that little notion in their head, you know, who else has walked up these stairs? Who else has worn this out or made this path? There's something very interesting and exciting about that. And I think buildings really preserve that. You touch a handrail that could have been the Pope touched it, or it could have been Paul McCartney or whoever. It doesn't matter, but that there's a connection. And buildings are just full of all those bits of experience. You know, you lift up a sash window and the little ring pulls, little brass rings, have had hundreds of pairs of hands through them, going back hundreds of years. And that's kind of special. There's something about that. In an old house, you know every board that creaks. You know, every lock feels slightly different. If you're blindfolded and you turn the lock, you'd know which door you were at without knowing where you were in the house. And it is that sort of, and it's character. I was always fascinated measuring these old buildings. And to find that along the length of a building, every window is exactly in the right place, even though they were built without computers or without lasers or health and safety statements or whatever else, was fantastic. That the quality of workmanship, the attention to detail, the pride in the work, the materials that they used, they were all just of a different time. That they were, I mean, John Ruskin said, when we build, let us think that we build forever. And I think that's key, that when we build, it should be for the long term. And we have lost a lot of heritage. And the one thing about heritage, when it's lost, is you can't replace it, it's gone. People think about environmental preservation and conservation and looking after the environment. Old buildings sort of fall into the same category in that people are aware of the Kyoto Protocol and our efforts to try and reduce global warming and carbon emissions. And what that process is about is trying to get different countries to sign up to certain measures and steps that will help us all improve the quality of the global environment. Well, similar exercises happened sort of post-war in relation to conservation, because there were things like there were conferences in Europe, the Venice Charter and things like that, where interested parties came together and said, we have to start looking after our heritage. And that has evolved. It started off where the first charters looked at sort of saving things like the Colosseum, you know, big important buildings. And then there was an evolution in that thought process to say, well, we should look after the environment around those as well. So the context in which they sit. And then in 1985, the Irish government, as part of the EU, signed up to a commitment to say, right, we're going to protect our heritage, our built heritage. And legislation then came into being in the year 2000. The 2000 Planning Act in Ireland actually protects buildings. We don't have listed buildings here. We have protected structures. And the hint is in the title, they're protected. So in other words, we have to mind them. The advantage of that, there are many advantages to it. If you have old buildings, from an environmental point of view, the carbon is already in them by and large. So you're being very environmentally friendly, repurposing existing buildings rather than tearing things down and starting from scratch. There's a lot of merit in keeping them. So that's interesting. I suppose the bit that I have found most interesting is getting more into the historical context of how buildings sit and where they how they came to be. And I wasn't a great student of history in school. I didn't really do it very much, didn't like it. But as I've become more involved in old buildings, I have found myself reading an awful lot more local history and Irish history. My wife bought me the Leaving Cert history book for Christmas last year, so I could get the context. So what you find is that take somewhere like Cavan and take Farnham Street, which is where our office is located, and it's a wonderful street. It's characterised by really lovely buildings and fine buildings. It didn't exist until the early 1800s, when the then Lord Farnham decided that he wanted to improve the environment and improve the area in which he was situated. And they laid out this very fine street and contributed financially to some of the buildings, the likes of the courthouse and the church. And then other people crystallised buildings around that, and you have the street that you have today. It's interesting that the first, I suppose, official recorded publication that shows the street is the first edition Ordnance Survey map, which happened around the middle of the 1800s, 1840 or thereabouts. But if you go back, there was actually a map commissioned by the Farnhams themselves, which I have had sight of. It's in Jonathan Cherry, who's a researcher in DCU, came across this map. Now, it's in historical research at the moment. It's not widely available, but he gave a lecture here in which he showed it. And it was carried out around 1760 or thereabouts and shows no trace of Farnham Street because it didn't exist. So all the buildings that you see on Farnham Street now have happened since that time. But the fact that we have this great legacy of buildings on Farnham Street is fantastic. Another, I suppose, just in the context of Farnham Street, there are a few things that people might or might not know that are really interesting. The cathedral, which is probably the most imposing building and the building most people would associate with the street, was completed in 1942. But not everybody recalls that the previous cathedral is now located in Ballyhays. It was removed stone by stone and reconstructed on the site in Ballyhays, which is quite a feat for 1940s Ireland when you think about it, and probably should be celebrated a little bit more than it is. That's one thing. The other thing is that when the Farnhams decided to make a street out of Farnham Street, they had to overcome the fact that there was a river running down the middle of it. So in fact, to this day, there is still a river, but it's under the street in a culvert, the full length of Farnham Street. So there are quirky little things like that that people may or may not know. In terms of I suppose, conservation philosophy, the ideas behind the sort of science that has evolved since legislation came into being directs us to, you know, mind what's there more so than replacing. So there's a sort of a central philosophy, which is that you repair rather than replace insofar as you can. And where the use of a building is no longer relevant, adaptive reuse, as it's called, is considered to be the right thing to do, but that you do it in a way that's modest. And if you have to make new interventions, you do them by using materials and designs and motifs that are legible today, that they stand out as being of their own time. And that means that future generations, when they come back and look at the work we carry out now, they'll be able to identify what we did and see where the narrative, what they call the narrative of the building is, that there has been a series of interventions which can all be easily seen and which are of their own time individually, and hopefully that they're all sensitive and all appropriate. And in an ideal world, there's this idea that they should all be reversible, that if we wanted at some point in time to put the building back the way we found it, we could do so. The other thing that's interesting is finding tradespeople and craftspeople who are interested in working with older materials and older technologies. And we're lucky that we have, you know, found people who are very good at repairing sash windows, at pointing stonework, at repairing brickwork, at using lead, slate, all those sort of materials. In Cavan here, we actually have pretty much all of those skills still available to us, and we use them throughout the conservation work that we carry out. I think some people are really afraid of getting involved with protected structures, and there's a fear that they're cold and they're old and they're drafty and they will cost a fortune to mind and to manage and everything else. And of course that's true to a certain extent, but it's only true to the extent that you want it to be. I think an awful lot of people have a dream or an aspiration to take on an old building, and maybe they're slightly afraid of it. And they're right to be circumspect. You shouldn't jump at it, for sure. But there are lots of, situations and circumstances in which it's been done and been done very well and successfully. And it doesn't have to be a huge country house. There are lots of smaller, more modest buildings and more manageable buildings. And look at College Street in Cavan, where you've got these beautiful, beautiful two-story houses, beautiful chimneys, lovely brickwork, and they have a huge amount of character, very well situated, that make ideal locations to adapt and to make very comfortable houses or offices or whatever you like. On the larger scale, what people have to have a little bit of bravery to take them on, but usually they're enthusiastic to begin with. And there is an awful lot of help and expertise out there. Apart from people like myself, the government and the local authorities are very good at publishing information, which is very accessible. It's all free to download. It's very accessible from the point of view of it's written in layman terms. So to get into the whole area of let's say taking on an old building and conserving it, the advice series from the Department of the Environment actually breaks it down by elements. So it talks about roofs, it talks about gutters, it talks about windows, it talks about walls. Each one is separate. And when you break it down into those elements, it's actually quite simple. And we've been involved with many people. I suppose a good example would be Caravan House, where the owners took the view that it was going to be, they wanted to do it properly over a long period of time and do it in a sequence and an order that would be appropriate and that, you know, would allow them to budget what they were doing, live in the house while they were carrying out the work without compromising their lifestyle. And what that required, and this is, I suppose, an important thing to consider with any old building, as with anything you take on, is to make a list and to make a strategic plan for how you plan to tackle it. So I suppose if we go to look at an old building in the first place, we want to look at the condition and get a sense of what it's like and start to make a list of the items which are absolutely critical, sort of a traffic light system, if you like, that says, well, this is absolutely critical. This is a sort of a like to have. This is the icing on the cake when we get to that. And you can then start to break down the elements and take them on piece by piece and not get overwhelmed, because it would be easy to be overwhelmed. The other thing is that there are grants available. They're not huge, but there are grants, and Cavan County Council are very good at supporting people with those sort of financial assistance. And they're usually targeted at things like a window project. So you might apply to the council for assistance to repair 10 windows in any given year. And they usually roll out these grants every year. So there are forms of assistance like that. And apart from, I think, the financial assistance, I think they help the owners appreciate that they're not alone and that in taking on a piece of the wider public heritage that they are getting supported. So I think that's very important. And if that could be increased more, that would be great. But it certainly helps people and helps them, I suppose, think about taking things on. And, you know, it simply is to be encouraged. There are too many good buildings out there not to take them on and not to preserve them for the next generation. And I suppose that's one of the whole central focuses of the legislation that makes buildings protected, that the buildings are to be protected not just for the owner or for the wider public, but for future generations. And I suppose that comes back to the environmental question as well, where people are now saying we're trying to protect the planet for the next generation. That's absolutely correct. And we need to bring some of our heritage with us for that.
What's it like to live in and care for a house dating back to the 1800s? We dropped in to Ian Elliott at the beautiful Caravan House to find out.
So the house was built in 1840 by Marcus Beresford, and he was a member of the Beresford family, Ireland's premier family. So when he was appointed as the Church of Ireland rector here in Drung, the old parsonage had fallen into disrepair, and it was a good excuse for him to build a new rectory. So he built a new rectory that was befitting of his status in Irish society, as he deemed it. So he built 9,500 square feet of late Georgian mansion here for this small rural parish in County Cavan. And after about 15 years, he got promoted, he became bishop, and he sold the house. It was his house to sell. He'd put the money up for it. And he sold it to Charles Leslie, the incoming rector. And Charles Leslie died in 1870. And when he died in 1870, the family decided to hold on to the building and build a new, more modest rectory for the parish. And the last Leslies here 100 years later were two sisters who had inherited from their uncle Cecil in 1930. When they died, they were the end of the line. At that point, nobody really wanted these big houses. They'd left the house to their goddaughter, and she held on to the house for about another year and a half until the bill for the death duties for the two sisters caught up with her, and she was forced to sell everything. And then the house was empty for about 5 years. In 1978, it was purchased by a French couple. They used it as a holiday home, really, whenever they came over from Paris. Well, he was working in Dublin at the time. And they held on to it for about 25 years. They really only lived on two floors of the house, and a lot of it had fallen into decay at that stage. And by the time she put it on the market, again, there was not much interest in the house because it was in Cavan. It wasn't in Dublin. And my wife and I came to see it, and we could kind of see through the decay and the dust and the debris, and we saw the house needed saving, so we bought it. I think it was the fact that it needed somebody to look after it. Because if it had been left any longer, or the wrong people maybe had come in and done the wrong things to it, the history of the house and the character of the house could have been destroyed. And we didn't want that to happen. So we took it on. That was it. It needed looking after. And we look on the house as if we're looking after it. It's hard to own a house like this. You know, you're never going to own it forever. And you just have to make sure when it passes on to the next generation that you're leaving it in as good a care and good a condition as you can. It wasn't our intention to buy a house like this. It wasn't our intention to buy a house on this scale either. But, you know, if we didn't do it, who was going to? Everyone's looking untidy studies. We've come through the front door of the house, main door through which guests and visitors were admitted. And the purpose, this space is a vestibule, it's an outer hall. And you're either going to be admitted to the rector's study, just here on the right-hand side, or you're going to go on into the house for a special occasion, for a family occasion, maybe to have luncheon with the owners of the house. The Leslie family, as they were from 1855. And the important thing about this space is that it was built to make an impression. We're in the library now. In effect, this is the second library that was in Corrivatten. The original library was really that study that we passed in the front hall. But this room used to be a morning room. But on account of the Reverend Charles Leslie's second son, Charles Robert Leslie, he was an officer in the British Army, and some illness befell him when he was at barracks in 1867 back in Glasgow. And when he came back to Corrivatten, suffering from polio or whatever it was that happened to him, he could no longer get up the stairs in the house. So they installed a lift in the house, in the study, at the front door. And that meant they couldn't use the study any longer. So they converted the morning room into the library. They blocked up a window and they installed the bookshelves all around the walls. And the bookshelves on the right-hand side of the room, they stick out about 6 inches from the wall, as you can see. And the reason for that is behind that set of bookshelves is the door that originally linked the morning room to the drawing room. And had they intended this to be a permanent change, they would simply have taken the door case off the wall, bricked up the opening and put these bookshelves flat against the wall. All the walls, all the internal walls in the house, when you go and measure them, they're all 2 feet thick. And that's a 2 foot mass of brick, handmade brick. It was made in a brick pit somewhere down the field here below the house. All the flues from the fireplaces, be it in the downstairs reception rooms, the kitchens downstairs, the bedrooms upstairs, all of those flues go up through the brick, and the heat radiates out of the flues into the brick. And this house, the internal part of this house, is a massive storage heater, and it regulates the heat all through the winter. I wonder if we go into the dining room. So when you live in a house like this, it tends to be like archaeology. You tend to read the story of the house by looking at what you see around you and what's left behind and changes that were made. This house could easily have been one of those houses where the windows went in it, the fireplaces were ripped out, the lead was taken off the roof, and the slate was allowed to fall in, and the house would have been a shell. So it's a lucky survivor, and it's a lucky survivor in so many ways, and more than anything, the fact that it retains all of its original features. And when you start to read into those original features, it retains its history. So this is always, there's two things I'll show you here. So what we've done now is we've stepped through the door on the other side of the dining room. And this is the door that linked the dining room to the service area of the house. So the area where the servants came and went. But the important thing about the corridor is that on the corridor, before these cupboards were ever put in, we have this wallpaper. And this wallpaper is made to look like timber paneling, and it extends all the way down the wall behind the paint that's been put in the intervening years. But the effect being that when the door from the dining room opened and the guests who were seated around the Beresford's dining table glanced out into the corridor, they saw this and they said, "Crikey, the Beresfords do have money. They've panelled the servants' corridor." And all it is wallpaper painted to look like timber. Conservation isn't always all that straightforward, but it is rewarding. And certainly anybody who comes to visit the house, I think, appreciates the house. I suppose you have to go in with the attitude that we went in with, that you have to be prepared that the whole house is never going to be done at one time. You're never going to be 100% finished. And people keep asking me, you know, do I think I'm nearly finished? And I go, I've been 95% finished for the last 16 years. I think the important thing as well about the house is the longer you live in the house, the more you understand it. So I think completely the wrong thing to do is to come into a house and immediately set about repairing it. I think you have to do the necessary stuff, and you've got to live in the house and you've got to understand the house. And then you can start to do the things that need doing. But if you went in with your team of architects and your engineers and your interior designers and set about full restoration of a house like this in 2 years, I can assure you, you'd only destroy it. It's rewarding to know that you're conserving a piece of architectural history, and that you're able to present it to the public as well. We're lucky that we open the house, I suppose, to visitors, and the people can come and see it and appreciate the house. They don't need to appreciate what we've done to the house. If they appreciate the architecture of the house, then that's good enough.
This has been a Cavan Heritage podcast. Thank you to everyone who gave their time to bring this piece to life. If you've enjoyed this episode of Where We Belong, please make sure to like and share. You can subscribe to this podcast to keep up to date with all new episodes. Until next time, slán go fóill.